We'll now move on, and Dr. Mark Pearce is going to give our next presentation. Mark is a, comes from Newcastle. He did his PhD at Newcastle University and then a postdoc over at IARC, and is now back at Newcastle, and he's a reader in life course epidemiology and leads programs of research into the effects of low-dose medical exposures, and he's also on the Kamari ward. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Yeah, so as an epidemiologist, I believe I'm in a very small minority at this this meeting, but hopefully what we do in epidemiology helps with quite a lot with radiation protection. So I will be talking about the just about CT in terms of the epidemiology studies that, are ongoing. I'll talk a bit about the results from risk projection models. I haven't got any results to present from the ongoing studies, but I'll also talk about trends in pediatric CT use, which is something else that we've been trying to look at because so little is known about what goes on in pediatrics. Start by saying the bit in red is the most important thing to remember in any epidemiology or risk-related study of CT scans. And I think I can stand up here and represent every epidemiologist looking at this, that they're a very useful tool. And whatever we're doing in trying to understand risks is to help the protection side of it, the safety side of it, and the understanding of risks. And the understanding of risks can only be placed within the understanding of the benefits. And so any studies that, if a study shows an increased risk of anything in relation to CT scans, we need to balance that with the benefits of having a CT. So just to get that disclaimer out of the way right at the start. So CT is a relatively recent technology, introduced in 1973 for head scanning and available worldwide at, well, the most recent figure I can find is 30,000 centres and continuing to increase. It would be great if, as part of the previous survey that you've done, if something similar can actually produce a more up-to-date figure so that when we do these talks, we can actually have that updated, because if you do a Google search, that's what you find from a few years ago. Situation in the UK was that 4% of all medical imaging examinations were CT, so quite a small percentage, but it actually gave 40% of the total collective dose to the UK population from medical X-ray examinations. You see a similar pattern worldwide in terms of the percentages in terms of CT use and the percentage of the dose. But there are differences between different countries in terms of the usage. In the United States, as an example, it was predicted that by the end of last year that CT would be used for 20% of all emergency department visits, whereas the figures in other countries are likely to be much lower, whereas there will also be some countries where they're similar or even higher. Usage is known to vary by country. I've got an example coming up of between the USA and the UK. Different regulation guidelines, again, following on from the last talk. Different healthcare structures and financing methods, and different attitudes in clinicians as to when CT is justified. Now, here's my example. I hope it's clearer on the screen than it is on the screen in front of me. This was from a paper by David Brenner, and looked at trends of CT usage in the UK and the USA between 1980 and 2005. So the UK is in red, USA in blue. And if you just look at the trends, ignore the numbers for now, you can see that they look quite similar. So it looks like we had quite a similar increase in CT usage in the UK compared to the USA. Now, in the UK, in 2005, there were 3 million scans. In the United States, in 2005, there were 70 million. Now, the UK is not a massive country. The USA is. But it doesn't explain that difference in the scanning rates. And the important thing there is if you look at the numbers over here, this is the number of CT scans per person per year. In the United Kingdom, in 2005, it was 0.06. If you look at the rate in the United States, it was 0.225. So you're almost five times more likely to be scanned if you live in the United States as you are in the United Kingdom. Now, what about children? I'll come back to this question at the end about in terms of trends of usage, particularly in the UK. But it's estimated that between 5 and 10% of all CT examinations are in children. But this, again, varies by country, in particular where there are different clinical thoughts for justification for using CT. And the use has grown rapidly over the past two decades because procedures have become much faster. And as a great example here is the faster the procedures get, the less need for, say, anaesthetics, and so that more smaller children can be put through CT. But then we need to work out what's the justification for that. Just because it's easier to use, do we still need to be doing it? Well, why study young people? And this is where I said that anyone who's in the session before will have seen the talk by Mario Del Bernier, one of my collaborative colleagues. And so some of what I'm going to say about the ongoing work will actually be very similar. But at the risk of repetition for the people that are in both sessions, we'll go through some of it. So children are smaller than adults. That generally happens. And so they receive higher doses to specific organs. We see great variability of doses. And procedures are not always adapted for the young patients. There are pediatric parameters that are dependent on age and weight. These aren't always incorporated now. Historically, it was even worse. They were either often ignored, or in the earlier machines that we're looking at, they weren't available. And then children have a longer remaining lifespan. So as epidemiologists, they're easier to study because they have longer time to actually demonstrate any potential radiation effects, which means that we can then look for smaller effects than we may see elsewhere. Well, what's known so far about the doses that we see at the level of CT? Well, other low-dose exposures suggest that there should be increased cancer risks at the level of several CT scans. So, for example, the atomic bomb survivors, nuclear workers, and patients with high numbers of X-rays. But what's known specifically about CT? Well, empirically, not a lot at all. But there are risk projection studies. Now, risk projection studies take expected doses and expected cancer risks, or cancer mortality risks, and try to work out what the expected number or rate of cancers would be given the number of scans. Now, projections are often limited to certain scans, so you may see that only one group of patients are actually included in the study. They often only have mortality outcomes, but most, when you look at the cancer rates and cancer survival rates, it means for certain cancers, mortality is really not a good outcome variable. And they make assumptions regarding modern protocol adjustments without going back in time so that we can actually, where we can see that the adjustments weren't done or weren't available. But they have produced some findings, and this is some work by another of my collaborative colleagues, Amy Berrington, who reported that risk projection for children with normal life expectancy, that the lifetime risk of incident cancer, this is any cancer, following a pediatric head CT, was 1 per 1,000 for children under 5 years and 1 per 2,000 for children exposed at age 15 years, which incorporating the age difference. Whereas for abdomen and pelvis CT, she didn't report any difference in the risks across childhood ages, but reported that there'd be one in excess incident cancer per 500 scans at any childhood age. So that's what we're looking at so far, just from the risk projection studies. But the big question is, are they right? Because that's the thing we don't know until we do an empirical study. Now, these are epidemiology studies, but they're not the sort of epidemiology studies that I do and my colleagues do. We try to use empirical data, try to use real data. Now, hopefully I don't need to say, go into how invaluable epidemiology is for radiation protection. I am biased, obviously, but it's a very useful tool. What I've said about the existing risk estimates from projection models, I hopefully haven't come across as being all against them. They're very useful. They are the first indication that we can use about what might we get. We can use those risk estimates to power our studies to work out how many patients we need. But it's much better if we can complement these models by direct observations of health effects, the health effects of relevance as well, in populations that we're actually trying to protect. And so to do this, we set up the UK CT scan study. 8 years ago this week, I was in the United States sorting out the funding for pilot funding of this study. So this is how far down. We've still not quite got the results out. Full name of the study is the long-term sequelae of radiation exposure due to computed tomography in childhood and early adulthood. We'll call it the UK CT scan study. For a while, we called it the Great Britain CT study. I'll explain why that is, because I want to point something out about differences in regulations. And this is a study that has been funded by the US National Cancer Institute and the UK Department of Health, with a recent extension through the European Union but I'm only going to talk about the original part of the study at this stage, and then I'll briefly say what we're doing with our extension. Now, I haven't got a list of acknowledgements at the end, because I thought I'd include it here. And just to point out that when we do these epidemiology studies, we don't just do them with just epidemiologists. We have to have large investigative teams with a wide range of people. We have epidemiologists, we have clinicians, we have oncologists, data managers, data collectors, statisticians, the dosimetrists, and the radiologists. So we incorporate all these different groups within our work, and so we actually end up being probably one of the most multidisciplinary disciplines in all of this area of research. One of the questions that sometimes comes up is, particularly with where some of our funding comes from, why are we doing this in the UK? Well, one of the great benefits of the UK that we're still clinging on to is our National Health Service. Free access to healthcare for all. And while that's great for patients, it's also really good from a research perspective, much undervalued from a research perspective. CT scans are performed primarily in public hospitals, and this is particularly the case for the children and the young adults that we're looking at. So we've got a way of actually getting hold of the data where it exists. There's also the National Health Service Central Register. So every person who is registered with a general practitioner in the UK is on this register. And from that, we can get cancer data and we can get mortality data, as well as if they've left the country, with the assumption that they do actually tell the authorities if they leave the country, which not everyone does, including myself when I lived abroad. So it is mainly complete, but there are limitations to it. Through that, we have a national cancer registry. We also have regional cancer registries that are very good. And we have a framework under the National Information Governance Bureau where we can obtain umbrella consent. So we can do this study without getting individual level consent, which means that we're able to get a lot more data. We can avoid the ethical issues of, if we had to get consent, we would lose patients because we'd introduce a bias. We may well actually scare patients so that they refuse to have a CT when they need one. And so that's one of the reasons why we take a really careful approach with this study, and making sure that even when presenting the study design, that we report it responsibly. Any drawbacks to doing it in the UK? Well, to be honest, not a lot. It's quite expensive to do this kind of research here because of our matching processes, particularly when you compare it to the Scandinavians, who've got everything linked up. But they're quite small countries, and we're, relative to them, very big. So we can actually find a larger patient group, but it just takes longer to do it. I've already demonstrated that we have a lower usage of CT compared to countries such as the USA, and I'll add Japan on there. And the reason I quote those two countries is that it's not possible to do the sort of data linkage that we do in our study in those countries. And so this is why the UK is very well set up for doing this sort of study. Our primary objective is to assess the risk of subsequent cancers in individuals exposed via CT scanning during childhood or as young adults. And that's in individuals who haven't got cancer to start with. A couple of secondary aims, which not quite as important as the first one, but still fairly important, I think, are to evaluate trends in CT use in young people. Rather than just having overall trends in CT use, what's happening in the younger populations? And look at that not just in trends over time, but according to patient and healthcare characteristics. And then, as you'll see, this study is quite large, but it needs to be larger still, or we need larger studies still. And so we need to actually have international collaborative studies. And so the UK study, being the first study to do this, spearheads the international efforts to have pooled results of much larger cohorts, increased statistical power, and the ability to hopefully even look at the rarer cancers. In terms of our study protocol, I think I've lost a slide. Okay. Do this from memory. We have a cohort of over 200,000 patients. The initial plan in our protocol was to have 200,000 patients. We actually recruited 245,000. From Great Britain, not Northern Ireland, and again, I'll explain that with a map that's easier to explain. They haven't got cancer to start with to be eligible for the cohort, but the 245,000 does include those patients because it's far easier to work it out retrospectively. Rather than going through and trying to say, to look at all the scans, we can't tell from the information. We get our data from radiology information systems, which doesn't generally have anything to do with indication. And so even if it was a suspected cancer, there would be an issue there, because what if it wasn't actually a cancer? We'd be excluding someone that we want to include. So we do it backwards, and we take out our patients at the end by using the cancer registry data. We don't have a control group. Now, the reason for this, or the main reason for this, is that it's a dose response study. And I wanted to bring this up because I've had a few questions recently about why such studies don't have control groups. And so if you've got dose response and you've got a study that's designed for dose response, it doesn't need a control group. And Keith's already mentioned that patients are different to the general population. So there's potential biases between exposed cohort and controls. What you want is everybody to be similar apart from the exposure of interest. Well, by adding in effectively a healthy control group, you already take that out. There's also an issue that we've uncovered fairly recently, is that in the north of England, where I'm based, we've seen that having a CT scan in childhood is associated with your socioeconomic status. So the children from the more disadvantaged areas have more scans, or more likely to be scanned and have more scans, than the children from the more advantaged areas. Now, in the UK, with our free access to healthcare, that may well, it's likely to represent the reasons for the scan, such as injuries. Whereas in countries without free healthcare, you may see entirely different results. And I'm looking forward to when some of my colleagues do similar things in different countries with different healthcare systems. We have a second phase. So the first phase is a cohort study. The second phase is a nested case control study within the cohort to assess dose response more precisely. We're accessing films for up to 8 controls per case. We actually want 4, but the trouble is that a lot of the films have gone missing because we're going back to 1985 in terms of our scans. And that was on the slide that's gone. So we're asking for them where they're still available. Now, why we don't then push on and say, all right, if the first 8 are missing, let's keep going until we find one, is that there's an issue there that you're actually more likely to have scans still stored from 20 years ago if that patient has been under continued follow-up. So then you introduce a bias by only having the individuals who are requiring longer follow-up and probably with a more serious disease. And for this, we're retrieving dose-related parameters. Somehow my slides have moved around. This is the one that I thought I'd lost. Okay, so our study, 85 to 2002, first scanned before the age of 22 years, and we've gone to radiology departments with available electronic radiology information data of sufficient quality, or just that it exists and goes back far enough. Not every hospital we've included goes back to 1985. We've included them if they could only provide 1 or 2 years of data, but the earliest goes back to 85. We've also got some film and paper records from a small number of trusts, but it's just not feasible to have a cohort of 200,000 individuals and get film records for all of them. It takes too long, is one of the main reasons. In terms of dosimetry, a good point to remind everyone that I'm an epidemiologist. The available information we have that we've used for dosimetry are the patient details, so the age and date of birth, the scan details, date of scan, scan site, type of scanner, and the details of the scanners used and the time periods. And we have cumulative doses where there's more than one scan. Now, our dosimetry has been done at the US National Cancer Institute primarily by two individuals, Kwangpyo Kim, who I'm not sure if he's in the room. Yes, he is. Brilliant. Hello. So Kwangpyo Kim, who was at National Cancer Institute, is now back in Korea, and Shin-Sik Lee. So two physicists who have worked very hard on getting us the best doses we can get. They're by no means perfect, but it's the best we can get. And in doing that, they produced some dosimetry software called NCICT. And the basic advantage of what they've done is to use more realistic bone marrow and anatomy within their computational phantoms, so that we think we have better dosimetry than any of the previous risk projection studies. And then we can use this approach to help the other epidemiology studies. So in terms of our exposure data, we approached over 150 NHS trusts or boards. They're called trusts in England and Wales, and that just tends to mean a group of hospitals in a similar region, and they're called boards in Scotland, where it means the same thing. So I will try and call them their proper names, but if I say trusts, I do mean boards as well. We got data from 72 trusts, so that's 97 hospitals in England and Wales, and 6 NHS boards in Scotland. And the geographical distribution is as follows. Fairly good spread across the country. Question mark for Northern Ireland is because, like Scotland, they don't have the umbrella consent rule. We have different laws in different parts of the UK, and so we're not able to... we weren't able initially to get data from Scotland until we had to go through different approvals. Same problem in Northern Ireland. We think we've fixed it. We just haven't actually got any data yet. Right, no results related to risk. But after excluding existing cancers and those not linked, we've got nearly 200,000 eligible patients. And we're taking a 2-year lag and 2-year exclusion period for leukemia and 5 years for both solid tumors. I'm sure I don't need to explain lag periods to anyone here, but what we're doing with exclusions is to try and make sure we don't have people who are having a scan for a precursor of the cancer, to try and make sure that we don't have patients who already did have cancer, but it just wasn't diagnosed at that point. And then we're playing around with sensitivity analyses of different lags and different exclusions to try and make sure that if we change the lag times, what impact can that have on our findings? What we have done is to look at temporal trends and other patterns. And this is something we did in North of England. This is the paper that was in. It was published in Paediatric Radiology in the middle of last year. And what we saw there, again, we only got to 2002 because of the nature of the study. We can't get data. We couldn't get data as part of this study any more recently because it wasn't covered by our ethics. And what you see here is that the number of scans, this is the males, this is the females, goes up quite nicely over the study period. But if you look at the number of patients, yes, it goes up, but by nowhere near as much. And so this is quite clear, and it's clear from what we've looked at in the data, that it was due to the number of scans per patient increasing. And so they were having more scans. It wasn't just about the number of patients increasing. We looked at the type of scan. Over 70% in both males and females were of the head and neck. Much smaller percentages for other sites. This is really similar to what's been seen in other populations, notably Israel, the United States, and the Netherlands, and France. And so to summarize our usage patterns, in addition to that, the usage patterns vary by hospital and type of hospital. And basically, as you'd expect, given the structure of the healthcare system in the UK, you see more infants and more multiple scans at the paediatric and regional centres, the hospitals that are designed to deal with either small children or more difficult patients. The median number of scans per patient was 1 in 93, but rose to 2 by 99. And there's a range of scans from 1 to 67 in our cohort. We don't know because we've got completely blinded the data in terms of the scans, but that, you know, that person with 67 may well have been a cancer patient that's not eligible for our study. But there are people having high numbers of CT scans and the resultedly high cumulative doses. In terms of international collaborations, there are similar studies that have been established for a few years in Canada, Australia, Sweden, Israel, and France. And you've heard a lot of detail already this morning for those that were in the previous session about France. And with the UK, Canada, and Australia in particular, we hope that between us alone, we can get up to 600,000 patients. But still, we want bigger cohorts. And so to try and make sure that everybody who in Europe that wanted to do this was using a similar protocol, I was able to instigate a collaborative European study that we then took forward, got funding, EPCT, and there was a map in the earlier session, so UK, France, Spain, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, Netherlands, Belgium, and Norway were on that map because that's where we're collecting data. The one that wasn't, I don't think, was Luxembourg. Now, Luxembourg are not contributing any data. Tiny country, they could contribute data, but the efforts we'd have to go to for them to collect the data is not worth it. But there's a group in Luxembourg that are at the Henri Tudor Centre in Luxembourg that are working very heavily in terms of the dosimetry side of things. And I'll come back to exactly what they're doing in the last point on the slide. For the UK, what we're doing is we're extending our cohort up to 350,000 patients under this funding, and then we're trying to get further funding to extend it up to what we'd hope to be 500,000, so that we would have a very large cohort, so we could do a lot of things just within the UK, but also then link in with the other countries to address further questions. All studies are using a similar study design. Within EPICT, they're all the same because it's one protocol, but it's very similar to the original UK protocol. The only changes are for the later time period, because we've extended it up to the end of 2011, so we can do more with more recent dosimetry information. And there are major collaborations underway about dosimetry, and this is where the Luxembourg link comes in. They've developed some software called PERMOS, which acts as a effectively as an automated radiologist or someone else accessing the PACS system, and can access the DICOM headers. Now, we're using this where we're allowed to do it, because one of the difficulties is getting hospitals to trust some software that's being installed on their computers and accessing their PACS systems. We can then use this to access the DICOM headers and get much better dosimetry, but only on these patients, because we can't go retrospectively before PACS. The PERMOS software has been developed for this study. We'd like to hope that it be useful to the radiology and medical physics communities to be able to get doses out of your own systems. And so one way of maybe increasing the likelihood of being able to do this in the UK is by offering that as a way of using it for other exposures as well. So there's no reason why this software couldn't be used for mammography, for example, and why it couldn't be used for other modalities where they have a similar PACS system. Our future plans, well, risk-based analyses of cancer in relation to dose, that's the obvious one. We're aware that we have uncertainties in our doses, so we're going to try and incorporate those into the analyses. We want to pool the cohorts for pooled analyses of risk. Initially, of the cohorts already established, that's likely to be the UK, Canada, Australia, and Israel. And then eventually to include the new European cohorts. So I think we'll have a three-stage pooling process. And we need long-term follow-up of all the cohorts, and we need to build links with genetic and epigenetic studies. So as a summary.
Less than 30 seconds, please.
Last slide, good timing. That was well planned. An international effort is really required to look at this. We need to establish large enough cohorts to answer the questions raised about radiation from CT scans in young people. And I think with the efforts that we've made with the original studies and the FPCT collaboration, and then with the increased efforts to get further funding, so I know that in the Netherlands they've secured further funding, they can extend their cohort beyond the FPCT funded amounts. We're trying to do the same in the UK. We really need large cohorts, so this is happening. But you need to give us time, because epidemiology studies of this nature are not quick, particularly to complete our initial objectives. And we need even longer follow-up than all the cohorts are initially funded for. This is not a one-stop study where we just say, okay, we'll look at a group of patients that were all scanned up to 2002 or in the EPICT study 2011, and then report on their what any cancer risks are in the next 4 years. We need to make sure that we keep going back to these cohorts and keep also improving the dosimetry. And one final, my only acknowledgement is my collaborator and friend Elaine Ron, who was integral in setting up the study with myself in the UK, who passed away in 2010. So thank you.
Thank you, Mark. That's fascinating work. I'm sure everyone will agree, and we look forward to seeing the results in due course. As we're running a little over, I'm not going to take questions. You can catch Mark afterwards if you'd like to question him further on this work. I'd now like to introduce our final speaker. It gives me very great pleasure to introduce Dr. Jean Turner. Jean is a qualified medical doctor. She started out her career in anaesthetics and then was a general practitioner for 25 years. She then eventually moved into politics as part of a bid to save a local hospital, and stood as an independent MSP for 4 years. And now she's the executive director of Scotland Patients Association. And she's going to talk to us about the patient's perspective on medical risk. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everybody, and thank you for inviting me. I have found this morning's session exceedingly interesting. And I think, speaking from a patient's perspective, patients probably, or people, shall we say, if we think about people in the first instance, don't really think very much about radiation. I mean, radiation is about as all the time. Background radiation, if you had a time in the Granite Cities, I did as a medic, you would know the background radiation is higher in a Granite City in other parts of the United Kingdom. But that doesn't really mean much to the ordinary person. You look at television and you see the terrible disaster in Fukushima, and people are very much aware of how nuclear radiation can be a bit of a disaster, not to mention tsunamis. And people do think about why on earth would people place nuclear power stations on a coastline when there's a great deal of volcanic activity. And then I think they think about governments, and even after that, they're really surprised that governments say that, modern technology is better and much safer, and safety is what people are always thinking about. But then they cast their mind back to Chernobyl, and you realize that depending which way the wind blows, it can land and contaminate the land in Scotland, and then the world becomes quite a small place, and how these things can affect you. But I think that I should say that Scotland patients